That's us. So, John, thank you for agreeing to talk to me. I'd like to start by just asking you about how and at what point in your life did you become involved in social enterprise?
Okay. I suppose it depends how far I go back, but my background before I got involved with social enterprise was in community development, and I was working, I think when I first started getting directly involved, was I was working in Shetland from 1978 to 1987. And during that period, I was working with lots of community groups of different kinds, everything from sports groups, elderly groups, music groups, etc., etc. And I realized that because it was a rural area I was working in, that there was also a need for some economic activity, although Shetland at the time was actually... It was boom time in Shetland because of the oil industry had arrived there, and so there was actually lots of employment there, but not everybody, you know, wanted to work in the oil, and not everybody had the qualifications to work in the oil. So that's when I first began to take an interest in how could you really the same skills as people use to start up a village hall or to run a voluntary organisation could be applied to running a community business or a cooperative. So that's how it started. And around about in the mid 80s, I was lucky enough to get something called an Arkleton Trust Fellowship, and that allowed me to travel in several European countries to look at how not just social businesses but also small private enterprises started in rural, particularly in rural areas. And I went to the Faroe Islands, was one of the places I went to, and this is just one example where a family had started up a small factory making gloves for the fishing industry. And so I took that idea back to Shetland and started a small corporate, or helped to start a small cooperative with two or three people making these gloves. So obviously then I had to learn all the skills of putting together a business plan and applying to the local authority and so on for that particular project. So that was the kind of origins of my interest. And then it moved on. The same time as that was when the community cooperatives in the Highlands and Islands were starting up. So that was... mainly started in the Western Isles because there was a concern about lack of employment there and people leaving the islands and so on. And that same idea then was taken to Shetland and then eventually to Orkney and then eventually to Shetland. And so I linked up then with what was then the HIDB, the Highlands and Islands Development Board. They had a development worker who covered Shetland and Orkney, and I started working with that person on other, what we would call, you know, community cooperatives at that time. And that included a shop in a local community where there was no shop at the time. And although, again, it was near to the oil activity, the shop had never been built for the local population. So I helped to start up a local community shop based on a mixture of voluntary input and some grant, you know, grant assistance. So that was the sort of second, the glove project, and then other ideas sprung up out of that, and then probably the next one that actually opened up and served the community for a number of years was a shop, a local, you know, community shop. And I've had a lot of involvement with shops right up to, you know, very recent times, because community shops, in a way, you know, encapsulate everything that social enterprise is about, because they're, you know, serving a need. They involve a mixture of voluntary input and paid employment, and, you know, they need all the skills that you need to run a business, but they are doing it for ultimately a social purpose. So those were just a couple of examples of my early involvement, So that's a long answer to a short question, but that was the first, that was my first involvement, really. And, you know, then it developed from those initial projects, my interest.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I wonder, when you were starting these first initiatives and the glove, making the gloves and the shop, was there kind of enthusiasm from the local population, or how did you relate to them and get them on board with this idea?
Right. Well, the glove project was slightly different in that the idea was that it would be a worker cooperative. So a worker cooperative is not so much involving the whole community, it's more involving the people who are directly going to benefit from the employment. You know, the product might be of use to the wider community, but the actual enterprise is not a wider community project. Although in that case, you know, it actually came out of a course that I ran on how to start a cooperative. So out of that course, a few people then took an interest in starting something themselves, and it could have developed into a community cooperative, but as it happened, that particular one was a worker cooperative. In the case of the shop, that was very much engaging the whole community. So that was, you know, the formation of a steering group, which then became the board and so on. So that was a much wider, you know, lots of big public meetings, you know, asking people's views about whether, you know, that was the way to go in terms of a shop, etc. And in that particular case, I mean, it's just a particular, you know, every project is different, but in this case, a lot of the people who got involved worked as firemen at the terminal, so they had a kind of group structure already. So you had, you know, various layers of authority within the fire service, which very effectively, in a way, they were able to apply within a committee setting, and they were very committed, and they also had a lot of skills themselves, you know, plumbers and joiners and electricians, so they were actually able to do some of the work themselves. So that was very much the whole community involved in that, and led by a group of, you know, very committed, mostly men, although there were women involved at a later stage, but the early stages was mostly these guys who happened to be work colleagues, you know, and then that sort of naturally transferred into them working as a group, as a committee to get the project off the ground. So that was very much a community, and that, you know, was, as I said before, was my own background, was community development, and therefore, you know, I saw it as a natural progression of work that I'd already been doing. So I knew a lot of these people in other contexts because they were involved in other groups that were involved in community activity of different kinds, whether it was sport or culture or music, whatever. And so you could, in terms of the committee skills and the, you know, engaging with the community and so on, a lot of those skills were already there. And so when they were ready to open as a shop, then they, you know, advertised and employed people as a manager, and, you know, the shop staff and so on were all part-time paid employees. So really from the very start, from the first, maybe it was 3 months or 6 months anyway, it was all totally voluntary until they built up enough surplus to start gradually employing people on a part-time basis. So that's how they were able, because they, at that time, there were no specific grants available for that type of social enterprise, and there was a particular issue in Shetland, and there would have been in other areas as well at the time, in relation to shops, because the local authority couldn't fund an enterprise that was in direct competition, or could be seen as being in direct competition with another enterprise, either in the same village or in a neighbouring village. So that's why there wasn't a lot of grant funding available at that time. So they had to build it up gradually from their own resource, really. and that's what they did, and that ran, as I say, for a number of years. And it, as a case study, it's interesting in a way because it traded very successfully, but and lasted for, and I'd have to check my facts on this, but I think probably about 7 or 8 years. But then, then they had difficulty in recruiting people to sit on the board, and this is quite a common feature of community business generally. Is that once a business is up and running, people don't always see the need to keep having a board that makes the key decisions, because they, in a way, they delegate the authority to the paid staff, which is fine on a day-to-day basis, but it's not fine in terms of, you know, having the ultimate decision making about investment and about number of employees and all that, which is more the strategic management side, which, you know, still should have a board to do that. And if you get disagreements within a board, or if the community loses confidence in a chair of a board or in the board itself, then that can create difficulties, which can lead to, in this case, eventually the shop actually closed, not for commercial reasons, but because they couldn't find enough people interested in serving as board members, which was sad in a sense, because the community lost that facility, and it was many years before a new shop ever appeared there, and the new shop wasn't providing the same level of service as the community owned one. So it's a sort of would make an interesting case study, that, because of the particular way in which it thrived, started up, was interesting, the way it ran for several years was interesting and successful, but then the sort of demise of it. And there have been failures in community business, as there have in private business, over many years, so that's not in itself is not unusual, but the fact that in this case it wasn't, it's usually the commercial side that fails, it's not usually lack of a board willing to steer the whole project, but in this particular case that's what happened.
I was also thinking, just as you were talking there, when the shop was running, what kind of benefits do you think it brought to the community?
Well, I've always maintained that shops are, almost a perfect example of how a community business can operate, because they offer benefits on so many levels. Obviously, the first one is that you're providing fresh and affordable food to a local community. But secondly, they have a very important social function. So a shop, and particularly if it has a post office attached and so on, is very much a meeting place, for people, and people who might be living on their own. It's a form of, they get some social interaction in a shop, which they might not get if the shop wasn't there. And I think all the skills involved in getting it up and running it are also important, because they can then be, from the shop you can have spin-offs, which very often happens in terms of tourist activity, tourist trails, or sometimes it can lead to caravan sites, or chalets or whatever. And horse riding, horse trekking, all kinds of hiring out bikes, whatever. So all these spin-offs can come from the hub of a shop, if you like, crafts, selling local crafts, for example. So you've got a market not just for local food, if there's local food being grown, you can sell it through the shop, but you can also sell local crafts and things. So, and sometimes cafes are very common attachment, so you have a cafe running alongside a shop. And from out of that, of course, then later there was a very specific community shop scheme, which was run by HIDB, so shops could then get specific grants to pay for a manager and pay for the startup costs and all the rest of it. So So those then developed, you know, in Shetland, Orkney, Western Isles, and some in Highland and Argyll and Bute as well. So that those community shops are still around. Many of them are still in place. In fact, in Shetland alone now, there must be 3 or 4 anyway, you know, still some of them quite new actually, so it's not something that just happened then and kept going, but there are new examples of community shops. And I later then worked for the cooperative group, the retail cooperative, and they for many years, they don't do it now, but they for many years they were the supplier to these local community cooperatives, so that there was a benefit there, and that was inter-cooperative trading, if you like. So that was also, you know, that's one of the 7 cooperative principles, is that cooperatives should trade with each other, obviously for their mutual benefit. And so that was a big advantage, that they could order and get their supplies directly from the big co-op, if you like, you know. And in very recent times, we had a European project which was about community stores in Iceland, Faroe Islands, Scotland, Norway, Sweden, and Greenland. So 6 countries were involved in the project for 4 years, looking at how, you know, we could learn from each other, you know, and it turned out really that certainly in terms of community ownership, Scotland was the leader still, you know, and this is in the 2000, finished about 2 years ago, so up until very recent times, Scotland's been a leader. There were other countries where the shops were more commonly owned privately, not community owned, but in terms of community ownership, Scotland was very much still leading the way, certainly in terms of how they developed and, you know, the quality of the service that was being provided. Yeah. So lots of benefits from community shops. Yeah.
And how do you think it differs, you know, why would a privately owned shop not produce, would it produce similar benefits, or
it can do, yes. I mean, I wouldn't be critical of privately owned shops. There are many cases. I can think of one in Lagan, for example, which is not there now, but in the Highlands, where it was a very progressive couple who ran it, you know, and it had huge supply of hardware as well as foodstuffs, and, you know, was very responsive to community needs, so, you know, whatever people asked for, they would try and get it, you know, into that shop. So, you know, sometimes you can get privately owned stores that in some cases could be better run than a community store, so it doesn't always follow that, you know, one is better than the other, but obviously a community owned store, when it's working as you would want it to work, then it will be responsive to local community. And in the case of the community cooperatives, they were based on community shareholding, so most people in a community, typically in a small community, would own shares in that shop, albeit that they weren't looking for a return on those shares, they were seeing it as an investment in their local community. And in that sense, there was even more reason why those shops should be responsive to their customers, because they were actually part owners of the shop. So where they function well, they certainly and generally would probably provide, you know, an equal, if not better, service. In some cases where they were poorly run, maybe a manager that wasn't fully up to speed, then, you know, they weren't always doing that. But certainly they all had the potential to be, you know, as good, if not better, than a privately owned store. And also they have, again, because of this community ownership, they've got more control. So, you know, a private shop could decide to sell up and sell the building off as, you know, into a holiday home or whatever. Whereas, again, a community shop, you couldn't do that without this, you know, without involvement of the membership in that decision. So it does have advantages, you know, in being community owned, and the fact that community, that you know, wider portion of the community is directly engaged in the ownership, and then, you know, they in turn can be elected onto the board and so on, you know, so they can have a more hands-on involvement in running the shop. So I think for all those reasons, the community shops are, you know, there's lots of other very good community enterprises, and especially now the trend is, you know, moving into the care sector, for example, and so on. But I've always maintained that community shops in rural areas, and that's most of my experience has been in rural areas, have been a prime example of how community business and community cooperatives are the model that works best in those situations.
That's really interesting. So that was that started around late 1970s.
Yeah.
And where was that?
Well, the first ones were in the Western Isles, because there was a lot of concern at that time, and still is. I mean, the situation hasn't changed. It has changed, but the problem still exists, where you've got young people, because they can't find employment in the Western Isles, tend to move away to the mainland, either for education or for a job, and then they tend not to come back again. So you've got depopulation, elderly, you know, aging population, and younger people moving away. So that was where community cooperatives were seen as, you know, one initiative that could help to keep people in local communities and provide local services. So shops were often, as I said before, they were often the hub, but out of that spun off, you know, other enterprises, ranging from tourist projects to peat cutting, I remember, and fish farming in some cases. All kinds of different types of enterprises spun off from that initial, you know, community core. And one of the original principles was that they had to be multifunctional. So in other words, they had to have more than one business, because it was seen that, you know, one business might be marginal or even loss-making, but you would have others that would be profit-making. So, you know, the two balanced each other out at the end of the day. So it started in the Western Isles. Then the idea was picked up in Orkney and then Shetland, but also there were some developed on the mainland. If you go, for example, to Argyll, if you go to a small place called Port Appin in Argyll on the west coast, you'll find a thriving community cooperative there, which has survived from the late 70s up to today, and they've built new premises, and it's still serving a vital, you know, playing a vital need in that community. In Shetland, you've got a place called Oliberry, Hillswick, Bigton. There's at least three. There have been others in the past, but there are at least three there. Orkney, you've got on the island of Papawestre and Edie are the two main ones on Orkney. And as I say, there are some on, you know, Highland and Argyll and Bute as well. So these have, some of them have come and gone, some of them, you know, have continued right through from the late 70s, some started in the 80s, and some are more recent, like the Bigton in South Mainland of Shetland started probably 4 or 5 years ago. So, you know, there have been some recent examples as well.
Yeah. And is there a consistency in the values of these enterprises, or do you think, you know, some things have changed over time in the way that these organisations have been set up? Or
No, I think the values remain the same, or the principles in terms of their, you know, structures. You know, that they're owned by the local communities. They're there to serve the local communities. Any surplus is reinvested back into the community. So those principles, I think, remain as strong as they ever have been. Some of the structures have changed. The original community cooperatives were used a model called the Industrial and Provident Societies type of cooperative. And that has been superseded by other models now. You've got kicks and you've got charitable companies of different kinds, you know, and sometimes you'll get a local development trust which will set up a shop as a subsidiary, you know. So the models have changed, but generally speaking, I would say the principles and the values, you know, linked to that have remained fairly constant. But models and legal, you know, structures change all the time. But I think the idea of trading for a social purpose is the kernel that still is there, you know. So it has to be, to call itself a community business, or now the more commonly used, you know, social enterprise, it has to be trading in some way, you know, either producing something or providing a service, which in turn brings in an income, and that income has to be reinvested in the enterprise, you know, not distributed. Where the community cooperatives differed, and where sometimes they were ineligible for and this problem still exists in some cases, ineligible for public funding, is because in theory they could repay some of the profits to the members, because that's how a pure cooperative, that's what, you know, it's there to do. But in hardly any cases did they ever do that. But if you looked at if you examined the legal structure, you could see that theoretically they could do it, and theoretically they could, individuals could benefit financially from being a member of that cooperative. But in very few cases did they ever do that, because, as I said before, when people invested, whether it was £500 or more than that, they were seeing that as an investment in their community, and they weren't expecting a return from it, you know. And that was very important in many cases in starting the cooperative up, because the original funding structure from the Highlands and Islands Development Board was that whatever you raised locally would be matched by the HIDB, so that was a very important sort of way of starting up the enterprise. Yeah.
Thinking about the Highlands and Islands Development Board, from my understanding, they were really influential and inspirational in kind of the community cooperative movement.
Yeah.
Looking back, is there anything that you would do differently now, or ask them to do differently now?
Yeah.
In terms of restrictions or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. I think one of the things in the very early days was that they spent extraordinary amounts of money on recruiting people from outside the communities, because I think the thinking was that they wouldn't find the expertise locally. You know, a small island might have limited people with limited experience of running businesses, etc. And I mean, they, you know, went to ridiculous extents of flying people up from London and so on, you know, to be interviewed for jobs. And in many cases, in some cases they were good and they made a good job of it, but in many cases they didn't stay for very long, and they weren't really suited to that kind of job. And in nearly every case, if you look at it historically, you'll find that eventually what happens is that somebody who starts off, say, as a supervisor, you know, so you've got your manager here who's got the overall management responsibilities, then you've got, say, a supervisor who runs the shop on a day-to-day basis, you very often find that eventually, and it could be after 2 or 3 years, it could be after 10 years, the supervisor person or the equivalent then becomes the manager, you know. So they may not be the all singing, all dancing person that they were looking for originally, but they're the person who knows how to run things on a day-to-day basis. So they probably were doing it for legitimate reasons, but slightly overestimating what was really required, you know, to run these businesses on a day-to-day basis. Maybe they thought they were going to grow much bigger, you know, quicker than they did, and therefore would need somebody with you know, lots of financial skills and things, but for generally speaking, you know, to run the core business, there was usually, as it proved, there were local people there anyway who, with a bit of, you know, in-service training and support, could actually run it just as well as somebody being flown in from outside the area. I think that's certainly one lesson. And certainly in terms of the link up with the co-op, actually, that's looking at the other side of it. The things they did well was actually, they made that link with the community, with what was called the cooperative group. It was just called the co-op then, but to make that link between, and I think that was a link up between the chairman of the board and the chairman of the co-op at the time, met, and you know, that was the outcome of that agreement, and that made a huge difference because they were able to, in a way, bypass buying from the local cash and carry, which would have been an expensive option. So they were getting direct shipments, you know, from the co-op, and also building up a dividend from that. So that it's a bit like your personal, private, you know, individual dividend. The shop itself got a dividend. So related to the amount it purchased, it also got an additional payment that, you know, went into the accounts, and obviously made it, you know, more viable to run the co-op and sell products. And also it gave them a wide range of products, you know, they got the same range as any other cooperative store basically, so you know, in that sense it was popular with local customers as well, because it gave them, you know, they weren't just selling the cheapest, they were selling a wide range of branded and co-op branded goods, and generally speaking, co-op branded goods have a high reputation for quality and so on, consistency. So that was, you know, generally a popular move. And apart from that recruitment thing, I'm sure there were other things at the time, but I don't. Possibly the structure was. Industrial and Provident Societies Act. I think at the time it was the structure that was, you know, worked well. It's been superseded, as I said, since then. But at the time, I think the structure was okay. They provided quite good training for the they had a team of development officers based in. The Auckland Shetland one was based in Orkney. Western Isles had their own development offices, so the backup for those early initiatives were very good. And historically, as a historian, you might be interested in that the idea didn't actually originate in Scotland, it originated in Ireland, as you probably know, in the Irish-speaking, the Gaeltacht areas of Ireland in the 60s were suffering the same problem of depopulation, lack of, you know, economic activity. And a father, MacDyer, I think his name was, got the idea of, he basically said, well, we're not going to get help from Dublin, we're not going to get help from our local, you know, our local authorities don't have the funding, so we need to do this ourselves. And that's where the origins of the Cahoman, which is the Gaelic word for a community cooperative, that's the origins of it. And HIDB sent a delegation over to Ireland to look at these examples. Glenn Colum-Kill was the first one, and they went over there, had a look, and they came back, and they basically wrote up the model, you know. And if you're doing any other interviews, another person on that specific one to speak to is a guy called Roy Peterson, who's based up in Inverness. He's retired now, but he used to work for the HIDB, and he was the person who was the main developer of that model within HIDB at the time. Yeah. He's still around, although he's retired from the HIDB, but he still works himself as a consultant, you know, these days. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you mentioned the HIDB as a kind of source of support. Mm-hmm. What other kind of support was there out there for community co-ops and community businesses?
Yeah, well, there was a local authority, and of course in Shetland the local authority had a lot of money because they had an oil fund which supplemented their normal, you know, rates, income and so on. but the models weren't very well developed then to support community-owned businesses. So you often run into this problem about competition, you know, that if you supported a community initiative, they were quite happy to support a sports club or anything that was totally voluntary. As soon as you started getting into employment and providing a service, it became more problematic. So the support was there, but it took a lot of lobbying, and you know, even to the extent of having to engage with the politicians to get, you know, approvals for grant approvals and so on. That the Glove project, which I mentioned, they did eventually agree to support that. And I think, it's a long time ago, but I think the shop, after a lot of lobbying and so on, did eventually get some support. But certainly there were no, you know, funds in the way that there are now, either loan funds or grant funds specifically directed at community enterprises. So there would be money that would be available for local business development, but for the reasons I've explained, that money was much more difficult to access, you know, because it was seen as either competition or it was just a model that they hadn't, you know, been used to before, and therefore they were more reluctant to fund it, you know. And I think there was probably a thought that, you know, how could local communities run? You know, business was seen as something that business people did. You know, it wasn't something that local communities should be tackling. And I certainly, on a personal basis, had lots of battles within the local authority because I was employed by Shetland Lions Council, arguing with the department that was responsible for business development that, you know, this was equally valid for support as somebody starting up their own private business. You know. So there were it certainly wasn't easy, and there were no other, as I recall it anyway, I don't remember much in the way of any external, you know, there wasn't the lottery funding and there wasn't the external funds available that are there now, you know. Yeah. So that was certainly a challenge in those days to try and find some additional support, you know. But as I say, there was also the local fundraising, which, because there was a model to support that, you know, now it seems to be crowdfunding and that sort of thing that seems to be more, you know, in vogue. But in those days, the idea of the community shares was the way, certainly for the shop project projects that were on the go, that was the way that they initially developed, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was just wondering, when you were working in Shetland, how much contact did you have with other community businesses in other areas? Were you kind of networking with other people?
Yes, yeah, very much so. Yeah, I helped to set up something called ACEHI. You may have heard of ACEHI was the acronym, which was the Association for Community Enterprises in the Highlands and Islands. And I was the first chair of that, and that was very much the idea of that was that it would be an umbrella body for all community enterprises throughout the Highlands and Islands. And we, over the years, managed to get quite large amounts of European grant funding and so on to support the development of community enterprises. But we also worked very closely with CBS, Community Business Scotland, and in fact, in that, I don't know if you've seen that little booklet, you know, 10 years on or whatever it's called, there's a picture of me there, I think, being handed a cheque for £500 from Community Business Scotland to help the startup of ACEHI. So we worked, you know, so they were, in a way, they were representing primarily urban areas, although there were some rural areas as well, and we were the kind of Highlands and Islands rural area, you know, and we had joint meetings and conferences and things. So there was quite a lot of link up there, and I did that from when ACEHI started until I left Shetland, which was in 87. So we must have started ACEHI, I think, in the mid 80s. and then I had to stand down because I was moving. I then moved and became manager of a community enterprise support unit in the central region, as it was called then, which was Stirling, Falkirk and Blackmannanshire. So I was based in Stirling, and at that time, and you would have heard this from Alan and others, that's when every regional council area in Scotland had its own development unit, apart from the Borders. I think was the only one that didn't have one. So I was manager of the one from 87 to 94. I was manager of that, and that's a whole new era then of, you know, a very exciting period in the development of community business, particularly because again you were working. Most of our funding then came from Urban Aid, which was the, you know, funding that was available then for areas of disadvantage, and there were a number of them, pockets in Stirling, pockets in Falkirk and pockets in Blackmannanshire. So our remit was to work closely with those communities, and I suppose over the years we probably helped to set up 20 to 30 community businesses, and we also then moved into credit unions, and we also community businesses and credit unions were the main part of our work then through to 94. This is just sort of my own development, as it were. 94 to 2000 I worked as a freelance, and that's when my experience in Sweden and other countries, that's where we kind of exported the model, if you like, to other countries. And then from 2000 to when I retired in 2011, I was working for the cooperative group as a membership officer for the Highlands and Islands. And although I didn't have a specific remit for working with smaller cooperatives, I did have a remit to maintain the links between the community co-ops who were buying from the co-op, and also any new ones setting up, you know, helping them to get into the co-op buying system and so on. So that's sort of, you know, if you like, where my origins were in those early days in Shetland, seeing it from a community development perspective, moving on then to helping to set up cooperatives within Shetland, and then I suppose on a personal basis that, you know, I became more and more interested in that, which is why I applied for the job in Central Region. We had a staff of 15, I think, in the end, so it was quite a big organisation, covering, as I say, central part of Scotland, and then moving on from that to, you know, working as a freelance, and then back into, if you like, full-time paid employment with the cooperative, but still that link between the co-op, the big co-op, and the smaller community co-op shops. And in that period was this project, European project, with the community shops as the focus. And over the years, Alan will have told you, I'm sure, all the various European projects that we've had as well. The shops one was one I was heavily involved with, but before that we had something called CEPCESA, CEPCESA, which was community enterprise and social auditing, and that was a European, you know, several European countries involved in that as well. So I suppose, as I say, my origins are in community development, seeing the links between that and economic development, linking the two together at a local level, and then into a more international level, and then more recently back into the local level, but from the working from the co-op's principles, if you like, of supporting other co-ops, you know, inter co-op trading, as it were. So that's where I've. That's been my development, but I think equally that tracks in a way what was going on, you know, within the movement as well, all the way through that period, you know, from the late 70s, you know, through to 2000, and, well, through to now, really. Yeah.
So, when you arrived in the Central Region, mm-hmm. Was there any difference in the kind of challenges that people were facing, you know, in comparison to Shetland? I mean, it was really quite a different environment.
Yes, very much so, yeah. And there was lots of headlines in local papers about this bearded man flying in from Shetland, you know, into urban Scotland. So it was quite an interesting contrast. I had worked in my training as a community worker, I had worked in urban areas, so I wasn't totally unfamiliar with, you know, urban the issues of urban areas, but it certainly was quite different. Although if you go into parts of Falkirk and parts of like Manningshire and Stirlingshire, of course you've got some quite rural bits there as well, although that wasn't primarily where we were working, because the areas of disadvantage obviously were all in the big towns, you know, of Falkirk, Stirling and Alloa. So it was different in the sense that the, you know, your location was different. But I think what I tried to bring from the Highlands and Islands was that, you know, community engagement side, which I always believed was, you know, a vitally important ingredient of the whole thing. You know, you get some community businesses that become quite inward looking and they simply there to trade, and they, you know, tap into any grants that are available for providing insulation or whatever it might be, and, you know, they operate well and they provide a service, but they don't really reach out much to their local community. So I think that perspective we continued, because we were a completely new organization, so I think from the beginning we again used a community development approach, in the sense that we always, you know, started off with local public meetings and tried to inform people about what a community business was, rather than just gathering a small group of activists and working with them. We tried to widen it out into local communities, and, you know, there is a difference. Clearly, you don't always find the same buy-in, you know, in a bigger urban environment where there may be social problems, maybe, you know, crime and drugs or whatever, you know, other issues that people would see as more important. You know, you don't always get the buy-in, but, you know, we always worked, as I say, on the basis we had a team of development workers, and we very much saw their job as working, first of all, you know, opening it up to the whole community, out of that gathering a group who would then, you know, take a project forward, and also being aware of any local gaps in services. So we did, in fact, there were one or two places where shops were established, although that wasn't the main activity. A lot of it was, as a great example, in started at the time that CESU was on the go in Alloa Community Enterprises does all the glass recycling for the whole of Clackmannanshire, which was unique at that time. I think it happens in more areas now, but that was a good example of something where they were providing a local service, quite a lot of local employment, and they had a board that, you know, ran the whole thing. But there were other examples. You know, that was, you know, you get some community businesses that from day one are successful as businesses, and that was a good example. And the chairman of that, for example, had worked at BP at the Grangemouth plant, so he had a sort of business background, and so that was quite. But then you get other ones which, you know, try to set up a local printing company, for example, in Tillicoutry. No, it wasn't Tillicoutry. It was one of the villages anyway, near Stirling, in Clackmannanshire, and that was more, you know, trying to answer the needs of local groups who needed posters made, or, you know, annual reports printed or whatever. And that wasn't so successful commercially, but it was successful, you know, in terms of engaging with a wider community groups and so on. So we had quite a mix of businesses there, some, you know, more commercial, some less commercial, but it's not always the case, but you could almost say that the ones who focus very much on becoming successful economically, you know, viable, because their focus is on that, are not always so good at engaging with local communities. It's not as clear cut as that. There's examples of both, you know, working well together, but that, I would say that's, you know, as a general rule, that probably is the case. And the ones who, and cafes are a classic example, and I always used to say, one more person comes to me in, you know, with an idea for a cafe, I'll scream, because we knew, you could almost tell from day one they weren't going to be viable, because they, very often local committees say, we need a cafe, and you say, yeah, sounds like a great idea, we need somewhere where people come together, yes, great idea, how are you going to make it pay? Because what they often say is, alongside those first two principles, is it must be affordable. So, you know, instead of paying $2.50 for a cappuccino, we're going to sell our cappuccinos at £1. And you say, yeah, well, that's okay, but how are you then going to pay the wages and so on and so on, you know. So cafes weren't always, there were lots of cafes, but they weren't always, you know, financially successful. One extraordinary one which we set up, or helped to set up, try and avoid the word setting up, it wasn't us that did it, but helped to set up, is in Cowie, the village of Cowie, which is in one of the ex-mining villages outside Stirling. And they had a big factory there which made medium density fibre board, you know, the stuff that's used for flooring and so on. Horrible process, you know, it uses formaldehyde, there's constant pollution coming out of the chimneys, and it's right beside, you know, lots of housing schemes and so on. So the local community had a sort of open day to see what they could, you know, what people's ideas were. And the local manager of the local factory came along, and he was dead keen to do something for the community, because it had a lot of bad publicity about pollution and so on. So what they came up with, and it's still going, you can go out and see it, you know, today, it's still there. They came up with using the waste product from the factory, which they couldn't do anything with, to make into what they call bearers, which are like just lengths of wood like that, nailed together. And when they load these big 8x4 sheets onto a lorry, these bearers go in between them just to separate them. I mean, it's a dead boring process, but somebody, you know, it's a job they need. They need those bearers. And they were getting them done a long way away, so the transport costs. And they said, right, we'll help you to build a factory right almost next door to the big factory. You can make those bearers. You can also diversify into other products. But as long as we get our bearers, we'll pay you X amount for those bearers, and you will both, you know, it's mutually beneficial. And that's what they did. And, you know, there's very few examples of community businesses in manufacturing, albeit that in this case it was a fairly mundane, boring process. They weren't producing anything very creative. And they did try and diversify into things like dog kennels, and because there was lots of spare board that, you know, could have been used, but they just found that in order to maintain this main contract, once you started diversifying, it was difficult to keep that going, you know. I haven't been there in very recent times, but so they may have cracked that one, but that was, they found, was the difficulty with trying to make, you know, other products in addition. But, you know, it just shows the range from, you know, a local store to a printing business to, you know, manufacturing. You know, it's all there, but on a smaller scale than, you know, in conventional businesses, and all started sometimes for very, you know, quirky reasons. You know, the fact that that guy happened to come along to that meeting and was keen to do business, as it were, was how that business originated. And I can remember going with the chairman of the board around to lots of manufacturers around Grangemouth, Glasgow buying saws. We didn't know one saw from, you know, the next, and we were buying this very expensive equipment because you have to have very special saws to cut this board. You know, they get blunt very quickly, and you have to know how to sharpen things. So, I mean, we did get some professional advice, but that was how we helped to start up that particular business, which I think employs, from memory, about 12 people full time and well paid. You know, not low wage. I mean, it's a normal, you know, production workers' wage. So that was one we were very proud of, that we succeeded, and it was commercially viable pretty much from day one, really, once they'd repaid the loan for the building and things, and they got grants because it was in a designated urban aid area. They got, you know, there was some assistance available for that, but that was also a very strong community, because it was an ex-mining community, so they set up a credit union also, as well as the Kerwe Community Enterprises, because once that manufacturing thing was up and running, apart from having its board, which were elected from the community, it wasn't the kind of business that, you know, it wasn't like a shop where you got lots of people using it and so on. So it was slightly isolated in a sense, you know, in a contrast to a shop where you got people coming in all the time. So they then set up a credit union. They then tried a cafe, which did run for a few years, but eventually folded. And I think there were one or two other, you know, businesses they tried as well. So you get quite a lot of that, and you'll find, I'm sure, when you talk to other people, where you get things that are tried, you know, but don't always succeed. Usually because if it's based on grant money, the grant money eventually runs out. And of course, these days you're in a totally different scenario because grant money is so hard to come by. So it's either going to take loans or crowdfunding or some other way of raising money. Lottery, obviously, lottery is a big, so a lot of money from the lottery goes towards community businesses.
Let's talk a bit about that changing money situation. So the grants came to an end, was it early 1990s?
Yeah, I don't know if there was an exact sort of, you know, cut-off point, but certainly in terms of the money that was available, because sources of money, of course, change constantly. So urban aid money was around, certainly through, when was it the first Labour government came in, was it 97? Not the first, but, you know, the first in recent times, yeah. So it probably was about then things, because urban aid was changed, I think, then. Probably from then you started seeing a decrease, but then, and that, you know, because local authorities had less money then, central government, you know, has really waxed and waned in terms of its support over the years. So and then the lottery, when I used to bring a lot of Swedish groups over to Scotland in the 90s, and you know, they were always amazed by this lottery funding, you know, because they didn't have any equivalent to that in Sweden. So the lottery, I think, certainly not so much in rural areas as well, actually, lottery, in a way, the lottery took over from money which had previously been coming from the private sector, that's as I recall it anyway. So the lottery became more and more important, but then you began to see the development of loan, you know, social enterprise loan funds and so on, which weren't available in my, you know, when I first started. So borrowing money became much more of a feature than it had been previously. I think, you know, in the early days, we tended to either raise money local, or no, it was a combination of raising money locally and matching that with money that would come generally from the public sector. Whereas after that, I think the model became more and more you know, diverse, so that you had lottery funding, you still had a little pockets of public sector money. It didn't go away. I mean, it's still around now, but it's very limited now. And then, because now, of course, you have got public money, but it's based on contracts. So it's that contractual arrangement that's also, you know, in relative terms, newer than there was. That wasn't so common in my early involvement, to have these, you know, contracts and what do you call them, the service agreements and things like that, you know. So so that's become more common, and dedicated loan funds have become, we did actually start, both CBS and I can't remember, but CBS certainly started a loan fund at one stage, and you know, there were various bodies like the Charities Bank and the Trade Union Bank and so on that you could go to, you know, that were non-conventional, you know, sources of money, if you like. And certainly when, even in the early days of community business, we would mercilessly, you know, use any source of money we could find, you know. So we'd go to oil companies, or we'd go to you know, charitable, you know, the word that if you searched around, you could find odd organizations that would provide some funding, but it was never in big amounts of money, you know, small pockets of money that might pay for an annual report or might pay for a, you know, training course or whatever. So we were looking for other sources at that time, but there weren't as many dedicated loan funds. Or, and then of course European money has been a factor all the way through. There's always been European money available in various guises, through LEADER in rural areas, through Northern Periphery Programme, which was how we funded the community shops project, the recent one. CAESA was normal EU rural development funding, you know. Oh, there must have been another funding in that as well. Oh, no, it was the Equal Project, I think, which was not, which was urban and rural, you know, could be either. So I think that was Equal, funded by Equal. So European funding, but European funding's never paid for running costs or, you know, startup costs. It's always been an additional funding that could be used to bring people together normally, or to research a particular aspect of a business or whatever. So European funding's been useful, but it's not been what it's not been, you know, for running costs or core costs in any way.
Do you think that having to work to contracts and service agreements, do you think that's changed the nature of social enterprise in Scotland?
Yeah, I think in many ways they've had to become more focused and more business, you know, business wise, because you know, the whole world of contractual agreements is, you know, complex and requires specific skills and knowledge of how you put in bids and so on. You know, we used to do some of that even in the early days, but we always struggled a bit because we didn't have the expertise to do that, you know. Although, having said that, when I think of the early security businesses, for example, in Glasgow, even at that stage you had very enlightened people within local authorities who could see that it wasn't a level playing field, you know, that if your community business in Drumchapel was bidding for a security contract against a multinational company, clearly they weren't going to win it, you know. But they could see that you had to build in social factors, you know, and other, what would be the, you know, if you gave this contract to Drumchapel, what would be the ultimate benefits. And in fact, in some cases they were successful because they were able to argue this is going to be local employment, you're actually going to get more success with your security because there'll be more acceptance of a locally owned business than a, you know, multinational coming in, and so on. And so they built in these clauses which now have become more common again, But they were actually being done, but only in pockets, not as a general rule. So that kind of thinking was around even in those days, you know, which, you know, to make it possible for a small community business to be successful in getting a contract. So I think the nature has changed, and I think in terms of, as I say, my interest and background in terms of engaging with the community, you know, as they become bigger and more complex, in some ways it becomes, you've either got to say, well, let's run this business as a business and have people who do that, but let's not forget that we're here to serve the community. So, you know, whether it's through a cafe or a shop or whatever, I think in an ideal situation you want to have both, you know, running at the same time, you know, because your business, let's say it's a cleaning contract or a security contract, whatever, you know, that apart from the people who are directly employed in it and the board who are making the decisions, it's not something that's going to engage the local community very much. So I think, you know, to my mind, there's always got to be that community, both engagement, but also community, you know, community benefit that's visible. You know, okay, that security company, you know, depending on what they do with their profits, you could argue will benefit the community. You know, they might give grants to local groups or whatever, but it's less visible, I think, than a cafe or a shop or a second-hand shop or whatever it might be, you know. So to me, because inevitably it's gone down that route, it means that the nature of it has changed, which in turn means that I would say the community benefit is less visible and less tangible, and in some cases isn't there in the way that I would argue it was in the early days, you know, in the that sounds a bit presumptuous, but I don't mean it was necessarily better then, because clearly we did a lot of things that weren't viable economically and therefore in the longer term didn't benefit the community because they folded or whatever. So we were perhaps more experimental, and sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Whereas now, I don't think they can afford to, you know, maybe take those risks to the same extent. Although, having said that, I think one of the issues with this contractual, these contractual arrangements is that in many cases, because the contracts are so big, community businesses actually aren't geared up to take them on anyway, but they try to and then they fail, you know, and there have been some spectacular failures is the wrong word, but certainly spectacular you have to call it fail, you know, they failed to carry out the contract basically because they haven't had the expertise or they haven't had the backup that you would get from a big company, you know. So I think that there are problems with it, but it seems to be the way that the only way that the community business can, you know, can get work, if you like, is by bidding for these contracts, and because the contracts are often large, they find it difficult to A, to get them in the first place, and B, to fulfill them if they do get them, you know. So I think there's, and I think there is work done on trying to break contracts down into smaller chunks so that, you know, it makes it easier for community businesses to bid for them, you know. But it does change the nature of it, because you then need, I was going to say, an army of people, not, I don't mean that literally, but you do need more people who are very business focused, you know. And I think there's a danger that you lose, if you like, your links with your local community.
I suppose one way that people involved in social enterprises try to grapple with those problems is through social accounting.
Yeah.
What kind of, how have you seen that develop over your career?
Well, I was involved with, like Alan Kay, you know, in the sort of early days where the model was developed. I wasn't the developer of the model, but, you know, when John Pierce and others were doing that, I was certainly very much part of, you know, those early days of developing it. And I remember, I can't quote the year off the top of my head, but I was on a panel for Tradecraft, you know, which is the social enterprise that imports goods and sells on to fair trade shops and so on. And that was one of the very early social audits. So I have had a long involvement with it. And I think it's absolutely crucial, you know, it's a crucial part of the two go together, if you like. I think, you know, any community or social enterprise that doesn't do social auditing is missing out, not just for the sake of doing them, but because that, you know, validates that they do have economic, social and environmental, you know, interests at their core, and they can prove it, you know, through us or not prove it, as the case may be, but certainly that mechanism to prove that what they're doing fulfills what a social enterprise is really all about is vital. And I suppose it's a disappointment in a way that it's not been adopted as widely, and there aren't as many social accounts produced as, you know, ideally many of us would like to have seen. Having said that, where they are done, you know, I've seen examples. I was worked for many years in Northern Ireland, and I can remember it was called the Verb Centre. It was a very innovative project, arts and cultural project in Derry. And they decided to do a social audit, and they did it. And then they went quite shortly, and they didn't do it for the purpose, but quite shortly after that, they went for a huge funding package. And the crunch that decided them getting this money was the social audit, because the funders could see that they were serious about proving, you know, and improving, you know, all the principles of social auditing. And so, although they had to have their, you know, funding bid was here, but beside it was a social audit, and the two together, you know, made the difference basically in that particular case. So I think, quite apart from, you know, being a nice and good thing to do, it has a vital role to play in applying for funding, or, you know, proving to the wider community that what you're doing is not just running courses or, you know, whatever, that you can show the benefits to the individuals, to the communities involved. So I think it's crucial. And again, it was along with exporting, if you like, community business, I also was involved in exporting social auditing, and in many cases they again adapted it for their own, you know, for their own systems, and have made their own models. One in Sweden is called Visa Verdi, which means showing your worth, you know, which is sort of the equivalent really, but just a slightly different and simplified. I think they were keen in Sweden particularly, they were keen to find you know, methods that you could, were computerized, for example, you know, that you could, so you could record all your information, you know, electronically. They're much more advanced in IT than we are, you know, in many ways. So you could, you know, and I know we do it here, but you know, you can develop models which are easier to input the information, and also, you know, are simplified, if you like, from the model that we have developed. You know, I think the model that is still valid, and you know, I know there's social return on investment, and there's other models now. They sort of grew apart for a while. Now they seem to be coming together again, you know, and recognizing that they're both different ways of doing the same thing in a way. You know, that would be my argument anyway. I know this is probably more nuanced than that, and Alan Kay is much more hands-on involved in that than I am these days, although I still am a qualified social auditor and have done a few in the Highlands in recent years, you know, chairing panels or being part of panels and so on. So still keep in touch with that, but certainly I think it's probably a disappointment that there aren't, you know, it's not more widely known and not more widely carried out, really, you know.
And do you think that local authorities and governments who are kind of dishing out the kind of contracts and service agreements, have they become more amenable to outcomes of social audits? Do they recognise them, do you think?
I think probably, you know, in the hard-pressed sort of world of social care or, you know, whatever local authority service it is, I think they very much looking at the bottom line, first of all, you know, seeing what the contract's going to cost. And I'm sure in some cases they do recognise the wider benefits of a social enterprise there's lots of, you've also got the whole area of employee-owned companies, for example. So in Highlands we've got Highland Home Carers, which is one of the biggest providers of home care in the Highlands, if not the biggest. And certainly there the local authority recognises the value or the added value of their business as opposed to a privately owned business. And Highland Home Carers also has done social auditing for the last 5 or 6 years, I think. So, and I think they do use those social audits when they're bidding for contracts and so on. You know, they'll inform the local authority that they're doing it. So yeah, I think it is taken recognizance of, but not, again, you know, linked to what I said earlier about it not being more widely, you know, adopted in the same way local authorities, you know, overall don't recognize it or don't even know enough about it to be able to recognize it. So I think there's definitely a gap there. You know.
I've got one last question on this. In terms of, you know, you've been involved in doing various social audits, thinking about the kind of benefits that come out of the social enterprises through that process, are they broadly comparable over different businesses, or is it a much more individual kind of social benefits that you see coming out of the auditing process?
You mean in terms of the wider community benefits, or
yeah? You know, what kind of benefits do you come up with when you do an audit?
Yeah.
And is that the same across a lot of social enterprises, or is it a much more individual thing?
Yeah. I think it's probably individual because it's because the audit is focusing on the activities of that particular enterprise. So, for example, in Highland Home Carers, they're very much focused on, you know, how do the clients see the service that they provide, for example, you know, and so they'll go to all their stakeholders that will include their own staff, obviously, but also their, you know, the patients or the clients, maybe the parents of the clients and so on, you know. But they'll also approach the local authority and the health board, etc., to see what their view is. And interestingly, I came across this when I was more actively doing social audits, is that often your public authorities don't respond when you ask them, you know, what do they think of the service that's being provided, because of their layers of, you know, responsibility and so on. Often you find that nobody's prepared to put their name to a document to say, you know, yes, we're 100% satisfied, or no, we're not, because they see that as something that comes out of the contract, you know, not something that you do separately by way of a survey or whatever. So I think the benefits to the enterprise themselves, the enterprise who continue to do it, clearly recognise the benefits, because otherwise I don't think they would invest, because it's time and money that's involved in, you know, and for a small enterprise it can be substantial if you start paying consultants, for example. I mean, in most cases now they tend to move on and do it in-house, so that there isn't a, you know, obviously there's a time involved and that is a cost, but you know, they're not having to hire in consultants every time, although when they do the actual audit itself there is some payment involved, obviously, in that. But the people who are, you know, the people who are giving out the contracts, I think there's probably less recognition of the value, and I think that's again back to the fact that it's not as widely recognised as, you know, ideally we would. would like it to have been. And if you look back historically, I suppose social auditing. I mean, when a few years ago, when the Scottish Government, for example, chose SROI as the preferred method, I think there was quite a lot of money put into that. And at various stages, social auditing has received money to develop the model and so on. But it probably hasn't been on a scale, you know, to make it more widely recognised and followed and accepted as something that's important. So I think it varies from enterprise to enterprise, but also in general, it's not as widely recognised as some of us would ideally like to see it, you know, recognised. Because those of us, suppose, who are have been directly involved in developing it, clearly see the benefits and see how it can make a difference. Whereas I think that's because it's not been as widely developed. Not enough people probably know about it to reach the same conclusion as some of us have. You know, so it's a kind of chicken and egg one, I think, in a way. You know, if there'd been a huge grant at some stage, whatever, lottery or whatever, to really push it, you know, throughout Scotland or throughout the UK, maybe that would have made a difference. You know, who knows? But it tends to have struggled a little bit in being recognised and being seen as a kind of, you know, slight additional luxury that, you know, okay, we'll have a go if we can find the money for it, but, you know, we're not going to push out the boat to see it as a top of our agenda sort of thing. You know. And even the ones who accept it, like Highland Home Carers, struggle a little bit to fit it into their day-to-day, because their focus is on fulfilling these contracts, you know, and they can't do anything that risks, you know, and they get, like all caring organisations, they get a lot of sickness and they have to hire, you know, get extra people in and things. So trying to fit a social audit into that kind of schedule when you're a relatively small organisation can be difficult. Yeah. And of course they've got their own, you know, normal financial accounts to be done as well.
I'd like to maybe move on now. I'm aware the clock's ticking away.
What is the time?
So just to talk a little bit about your work internationally and in Sweden, how did you get involved in that?
I think most of my international work has been through meeting people at, you know, I've always been interested in finding out what goes on in other countries in social enterprise and cooperatives and so on. So I, over the years, must have attended quite a few international conferences, and from America to Malaysia to Europe and so on. And usually it's through, you know, you meet somebody at a conference or an event and they say, you know, they ask you what you're doing in Scotland and you tell them and they say, oh, can you come and tell us about it in this case, I think I met the person, my original contact, I think I met in East Germany at the Bauhaus, which is a sort of centre for, you know, social and cultural development. It was a big European conference there, and he invited me to Sweden to inform people about community business, because Sweden has a long history of cooperatives, so it's not as if you're bringing in an idea that people have never heard of. So but the actual model of community business and community engagement and so on didn't exist in Sweden, so I was invited to speak about it. That in turn led to being invited to put in a bid to do a whole series of workshops, and both in actually developing community enterprise but also in social auditing. So both strands continued, and originally it was with one organization, and then other organizations got interested, so I pretty much covered the whole of Sweden apart from the very south of Sweden, although majority of it was in the north of Sweden. So very, very similar to the Highlands and Islands, you know, in geography. geography and isolated rural communities and things. So that was another benefit, I think, or as they saw it, you know, somebody who knew about remote rural areas, but also knew about, you know, community business. So that's how the Swedish work came about. And a similar pattern probably in Northern Ireland, and to a certain extent in England, actually. I've worked quite a lot as John and Alan did, in Liverpool, for example. You know, so various pockets in England became very interested in social auditing and community business. And in Liverpool, a few of us had John and I were involved with a social auditing contract to deliver courses on social auditing and on local economic development in certain, you know, of the what they call seabed areas, community-based economic development areas. So I had contracts there. One time I was working in Sweden, Ireland, and England all at the same time, which was a bit hairy, and living in Scotland. So they all came about, really, all the international work normally came about through meeting people working in the same field in those countries, being invited to speak at conferences or meetings or whatever, and then from that developed, you know, contracts. So that period from 87 to 94, that's pretty much what I was doing, working less in Scotland and more abroad, although I never sort of stopped working in Scotland, but a lot of the work tended, and partly because I have Norwegian as a language, you can work in Sweden and speak Norwegian and they'll understand that, and you know, they speak to you in Swedish, but so there's no language barrier. And the Irish work was mainly in Northern Ireland. There was a cooperative development agency in Northern Ireland, but out of the work in Northern Ireland, the interest developed then in Southern Ireland, in the Republic, and I had a big contract with FOSS, which is the government training agency, to go around again to areas of economic deprivation to talk about and help to start up community enterprises there. So lots of international involvement, but a lot of it again based on the origins, you know, of community cooperatives, community businesses, social auditing, that those three things together were what these other countries were interested in. And I think now, you know, in some ways they've sort of leapfrogged us in some areas, other areas they haven't developed as much, but at that particular stage, in that particular period, it was all new to them, so that's why they were prepared to, you know, to pay somebody to come and there were other people doing the same sort of thing at the same time. Sam's on my phone, sorry.
Down in the lane.